the early risers. It's ultimate test of our commitment. And thank you so much, Benny, for making us suffer. 20 years ago, when many of us started to address the issue of biodiversity conservation in a very dedicated way, there were two other issues that were emerging. One was the issue of climate change, and the other was the rules of trade for globalization of food and agriculture. Interestingly, it's literally now 20 years since the UN Framework Convention on climate change started to get laid out as one of the treaties that would come out of the Earth Summit, and the other was the Climate Change Treaty. But it was also exactly in this period that the Uruguay Round of GATT was, I would not say being negotiated, it was because it was not being negotiated, it was being imposed. And that's where patenting of life was being thought through. The Intellectual Property Rights Committee of the industry associations of the US, who drafted the text of the trade-related intellectual property rights agreement, have gone on record to say that in making this treaty, we were the patient, the diagnostician, the physician, all in one. We defined a problem, and guess what the problem is? That plants grow and produce seed, and farmers save seed. That's a problem. The solution was patenting on the one hand and genetic engineering on the other to prevent farmers from saving seed. I remember in the early days of the Convention on Biological Diversity, we had an ongoing debate on the sidelines between two kinds of NGOs, the business and industry, which calls itself an NGO, and civil society, which is there as an NGO. We all sit in the NGO side. And I remember when they were justifying herbicide-resistant crops, they were talking about how they have ultimately reached a technology which prevents other plants from stealing the sunlight. Because basically, as you know, herbicide-resistant crops allow you to spray herbicides and kill all the other biodiversity except the planted crop that's engineered for resistance to herbicide. In 92, we had a massive farmers' action against Cargill in Karnataka. Cargill seeds has since then been bought up by Monsanto. But when the farmers tore down the Cargill factory, this was a hybrid seed factory. Actually, they don't produce the hybrid seed in the factories. They make children produce hybrid seeds, or women produce hybrid seeds. They just package it in the factories. And again, the Cargill chief said Indian peasants were being very stupid because through hybrid seed, they had evolved a technology to prevent the bees from usurping the pollen. Now, that's the kind of mindset which has given us the biggest threat to biodiversity in agriculture. I can see my dear sister, Maria Mies, who was in Leipzig, and we drafted the Women's Declaration on Biodiversity, largely because nothing was moving in the convention negotiations, as nothing moves out there. So we made this declaration to bring the real issues to the table. At the Leipzig Conference on Plant Genetic Resources, government after government, when it tables its report, it was so clear that the single biggest threat to biodiversity was industrial forms of farming, leading to replacement of indigenous biodiversity and seeds with uniformity of monocultures or what are called improved varieties, high-yielding varieties and now genetically modified varieties. But the interesting thing is Seed replacement is now the ultimate religion of agriculture. All compulsory licensing arrangements, which are imposed in the world, and we fought it through a civil disobedience in a massive movement in India, and I handed our Prime Minister 5 million signatures to say, you dare force us to stop cultivating our diversity. We will disobey as Gandhi disobeyed the British salt laws. But in Europe and US, the reason the biodiversity has disappeared is farmers were forced to make it disappear by making their own seeds illegal through compulsory registration laws. I remember at a seed festival we were doing up in the very high altitude Himalayan villages, our chief minister of that time, Andy Tiwari, visited our stall and said, why are you saving all these seeds? Seeds are like automobiles. They need to be replaced. And I had to tell him, that's where you've got it wrong, Mr. Chief Minister. Seeds are not like dirty clothes that need to be thrown away or automobiles that have to be replaced by fashion. Seeds and life on earth and biodiversity can never go out of fashion. We have to keep it in fashion all the time. And that's our commitment at Planet Diversity. When in 1988, 89, 90, the community working on biodiversity conservation and the community working on climate change, very different communities. In fact, there were no communities in climate change because everyone thought it's all about the air. Yeah. It's all about, for the scientists, it was about modeling. And for the activists, it was about smokeless chulhas, I remember. Yes, these ovens. Ovens that don't give smoke. Everyone was obsessed with stopping the smoke. No one was obsessed with stopping the carbon dioxide burning of through fossil fuels. But a poor woman burning a little bit of cow dung and a little bit of firewood or a little bit of organic biomass from her farm, that was the big consideration. I think in these 20 years, as the climate change issue has emerged as a very, very serious issue, and as those of us who have continued to work on biodiversity and organic farming have realized, that actually it's in biodiverse organic farming and local food production that the biggest solution to climate change and climate instability lies. Let me run through a few figures. The Stern report put about 14% of greenhouse gas emissions out of agriculture. And that's only out of industrial agriculture, because ecological farming doesn't have greenhouse gas emissions. It doesn't have mobile nitrogen that creates the nitrogen oxide pollution of the atmosphere. Small farms of the third world, unless they're totally forced, have renewable animal energy as an energy source. Transport is 14%. A large part of that transport under the forced imposition, both by WTO and the World Bank and structural adjustment, is linked now to food transport. The category called land use is 18%. Most of this is accounted for by cutting down forests, rainforests, primeval forests, to grow soya bean or palm oil. So if you add these figures up, under the current system, we are talking about 40% greenhouse gas emissions coming out of an industrialized, globalized food system. Tomorrow, we can get rid of this 40%. You know, they're bargaining 20 years over 5% reduction, and even that target they can't meet, poor things. And here we have an alternative that says, tomorrow, if biodiverse ecological farming and localized food systems become the way we address agricultural issues, we have removed 40% contributions of greenhouse gas emissions. But it isn't just that there's a reduction of emissions. There is actually a solution by absorption. The soil, I mean, the beautiful thing is there's only one mechanism to take carbon out of the atmosphere and make it living again. To take dead carbon from the atmosphere, turn it to life. And that's the magical chlorophyll molecule of the plant. And, you know, Stern and everyone else in the climate discussion keep saying, oh, we've got to make carbon-free economies. You know, carbon-free economies, no plants, no humus in the soil. And just because they work on abstract levels, you know, now that there's carbon is a problem, they say carbon-free economies. But meantime, the very people who would like to banish even living carbon out of our imagination are the ones who are trading in it, who are trading in pollution. Pollution has been made the biggest valuable commodity being traded today, and it's going to reach $1 trillion of a market. It's already $30 billion. Can you imagine? The waste of an industrial economy becomes more valuable in the fictitious economy that governs us than the real life of this planet. Something is so wrong in the way, and I would say, given that so many of my sisters from Diverse Women for Diversity are here, the perverse way in which capitalist patriarchy sees the economy and sees technology. In terms of technology, it's only violence that can get seen in that framework. The non-violent ways of using technology, the non-violent technologies, the quiet ways in which the earthworm and mycorrhizae work away in the soil, can't be seen. That's not seen as technology. The way in which beans work with maize to create nitrogen for the soil doesn't get seen in a mindset where leftover factories from the war that were used to create explosives and now make nitrogen fertilizer. A mindset that sees that as technology cannot see mycorrhiza as technology, cannot see our work with the soil to increase soil microorganism populations as technology. In terms of wealth, very clearly, a bit by bit, the system of creation of wealth or creation of more food is precisely what has led to the current food crisis. You know, even till 1 year ago, when we talked food and we talked food security, the big boys of World Bank, the big boys of World Trade Organization, the big boys of Cargill and Monsanto would always say, we have the system to make cheap food available to the world. That's why we must destroy the small farms. That's why we must destroy biodiversity. And that was the justification of the agriculture agreement in the WTO. That small farms are inefficient. We can produce cheap food. Well, 2008, the argument of cheap food has disappeared overnight. And I want to just spend a moment on the emerging food crisis. There is a food crisis that has always been there with industrial agriculture. And that food crisis was related to the fact that 90% of the food and nutrition that comes from biodiversity was destroyed by the tools of warfare that were deployed in the name of the Green Revolution and now are being deployed in the name of the Second Green Revolution. All greens were destroyed. Legumes and pulses were destroyed. Oil seeds were destroyed. Fruit trees were cut down. As a phrase that has emerged out of Argentina and the spread of herbicide-resistant soya says so clearly, what is being created are green deserts. Miles and miles and miles of soya, miles and miles and miles of Green Revolution rice. If you go to Punjab today, in the wheat season, it's just wheat, 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 as far as the eye can see. And in the rice season, it's rice, as far as the eye can see. And the Green Revolution, which even today is being taught in textbooks as something that got India out of famine conditions. I just want to mention to you, 1965, we didn't have famine. We had a drought and we had food scarcity and the prices of food were rising. But people weren't dying of lack of food. In the villages, there was absolutely no scarcity. It's in the towns and industrial centers that were being built that prices were getting high. And this crisis was used as a conditionality to impose the Green Revolution on India. We did not choose the Green Revolution, it was forced on us. And we've done studies that show that actually the Green Revolution did not produce more food. My book, The Violence of the Green Revolution, a new report that should be available outside on the table on biodiversity-based productivity, all these studies show that actually per acre food production went down. All that went up was commodity production. But commodities are not food. First of all, food is eaten by the earthworms. Food is eaten by the cattle. Food is eaten by farming families. Commodities never feed the soil. They never feed the local household. In fact, as commodity production has grown, hunger in the world has grown. That is why there's already 1 billion people permanently hungry on this planet. No indigenous system of agriculture was able to achieve permanent hunger. It was left to the globalized industrial system to achieve it. We had short-term scarcity and we had localized scarcity. But permanent globalized scarcity for the poor is a result of the commodification of food, and the commodification of food means it'll only get to where the purchasing power is. It so happened purchasing power was higher for the poor pigs that were being imprisoned in factory farms and the cows that were being imprisoned in factory farms. I don't like to call it an entitlement, you know, because even the grain feeding is a punishment. That's not what our cattle were meant to eat. They never designed to eat cattle. And now with the emergence of biofuel, and I notice Eric will be speaking, so I won't talk too much about it except make a few points. The diversion to biofuels and leaving the poor of the world to compete with automobile owners and with the subsidies that go with the biofuel economy. They're twice as high as the subsidies in the food economy. Now, the subsidies in the food system already created the distortions, already led to the dumping in the South. But with the level of subsidies the United States government is giving to biofuels, there's no way food will go to the hungry. It'll go only to run cars. And I want to, on this issue, mention that there's always this talk about the market. One more construct of capitalist patriarchy. We must leave it to the market. There's nothing like a market. There are policies and laws that shape the structures of who will benefit from the market. The biofuel laws of Europe and the biofuel laws of the United States have created the market for biofuels. You scrap those laws, you've got no market for biofuels. There is, of course, another element to the current food crisis, and this element does not have anything to do with demand and supply. It's very interesting because, you know, as riots have taken place in countries with rising food prices, immediately the discussion has shifted to food scarcity. There isn't food scarcity. In India, the farmers are growing so much rice and wheat, they can't get to sell it because of forced imports from the United States. Stacks of bags of rice and wheat waiting to be brought to the market. There isn't a scarcity of production right now. The reason prices are rising is twofold. First, there has been a financial collapse in the United States related to the subprime and mortgage crisis, as a result of which the financial systems, the hedge funds and the investment banks, have moved instantly into primary commodities. And they seek 25% return on their investment. That means there must be a 25% increase in food automatically. In this year, the people who invested in food as commodities have walked away with huge profits. The second aspect of this is related to the fact that as the World Bank and as the World Trade Organization force the integration of local food economies into a global economy controlled by agribusiness, the triggers of instability in the United States start to hit the remotest village in food prices. Now, we have been talking at Planet Diversity about our connectedness, about our solidarities. We are talking about the connectedness of the soil to the local communities. We are talking about the connectedness of plants to the atmosphere. But that connectedness is destroyed as the forced connection of local ecosystems is established with the Chicago Futures Exchange. It's that forced connectedness that is also creating climate instability. You know, in 1998, we had a huge movement to resist the dumping of soybean, which at that point was subsidized by $200 a ton. We were forced to remove import barriers. And we were forced, I mean, our government, someone got bribed somewhere, and they banned local edible oils. I watched fields of fertile soya get destroyed. I watched coconut farmers of Kerala, the state of coconut, cut down coconut trees their ancestors had planted. And meantime, after having destroyed the local edible oil economy for 1 billion Indians, they go and plant soya in the Amazon. Now, it's part of this industrial system to necessarily destroy biodiversity and create green deserts in primeval ecosystems where there are no farmers. But how long can this process continue? How long can we constantly cut down the last forest? As the famous Indian sayings, Native American saying said, it's only when you've cut the last tree, kill the last fish, that you will realize that you can't eat money. And I was just told by a Brazilian friends here that Marina Silva, our environmental minister, the friend, has resigned from Lula's government because he has declared that the Amazon will be the new China. Now, if cutting down the lungs of the planet is the brilliance of Lula, can you imagine what the state of Bush will be? We do have real solutions. We also have to be very aware that the crisis, the triple crisis of biodiversity, of rising food prices, and of climate change will be used and is being used to precisely push forward the processes that have given us these crises. Let me just give you two examples. As the food prices started to rise, and even while the world trade negotiations have been stalled since we let to their, their collapse, actually, since Seattle, they haven't moved on agriculture, on further liberalization of trade. But the day the food prices rose, every country started to remove import barriers. Every country dropped their import tariffs to zero. WTO was achieved by the food crisis. I wouldn't be surprised if there's an element of this food crisis. This is engineered to achieve what cannot be achieved through democratic debate. The second is the issue of genetic engineering. Country after country has rejected GMOs. There are only four crops, primarily four countries, in the production system. Democracy is not allowing GMOs to spread. They're now using the panic of climate change and the panic of rising food prices to say, we need GMOs. a lot of environmental movements who don't work with the soil, who don't work with the farmers, who don't know the productivity of biodiverse ecological systems are actually saying, oh, you know, we'll have to give up our resistance to GMOs for the sake of protecting the climate. We'll have to educate our friends too. The problems are interconnected. The same forces that gave us biodiversity erosion, gave us food scarcity, and gave us climate change. The same models that we have evolved as a community, as a movement, that is here now as planet diversity, will simultaneously reverse biodiversity decline, increase the availability of food, and reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. For the first time, we are the solution not just to species extinction. We are the solution to the food crisis. We are the solution to climate change. But to get there, we will, of course, have to constantly mutually educate each other. We will have to inspire each other, and we will have to spread the practices we have built totally. You know, by learning from the land, learning from biodiversity, learning from the seed, learning from communities and elders. One thing I have learned in these 20 years of building these alternatives is one simple recognition. What is good for the planet is good for people. The more you protect life on Earth, the more you produce. You just have to change the lenses through which you see production, away from the lenses of monocultures to biodiversity, away from the lenses of a globalized economy to local production systems, away from the lenses of power, control, monopolies, monocultures, to the lenses of sharing the miracle and beauty of this planet. In Navdanya, we always say, food production is only an act of service. We merely have to serve the soil and the millions of microorganisms in the soil. They do the rest of the work for us. We don't have to produce food. We just have to feed. We have to not just feed. We have to avoid denying them food because nature feeds herself. And all that human beings have done is interrupt those cycles of nitrogen recycling, carbon recycling, the amazing hydrological cycle. I won't go into figures and details. There are many reports outside, a new report we've just produced on food versus fuel, a new book I've done on soil, not oil, that we've got to go out of the killing economy of fossil fuels into the living economy of the soil and biodiversity. And on 27th of May, the Commission on the Future of Food, of which Benny and I are members, I chair it. The commission is hosted by the region of Tuscany. The formal release of our report and manifesto on food security in times of climate change will take place 27th of May. You can find it at the website future-food.org. You can also get it by emailing futureoffood_Tuscany@yahoo.com. We are in a new exciting phase. And that new exciting phase is this integration of what appear to be multiple problems, but are really one problem. One problem of the idea that nature must be destroyed to improve human life. And secondly, the idea that the mistake that was made by the rise of an industrial culture and the rise of capitalist patriarchy will find us the solution. As Einstein said, the mindset that gave us the problems cannot give us the answers. Nature will give the answers. Women will give the answers. Future generations will give the answers. And while we have to recognize that in 10 years, this momentum of this obsolete dinosaur could take the world down with it, the momentum of our small actions, working in joy, working in service, working in solidarity, we don't know when they will be large enough to make a huge difference. Let's work together for the next 20 years.